how entirely compatible that way of living then was with the most useful and beneficent activities his life shows. Right aspiration, right effort, and right livelihood distinguished his career. He organized a great digging of wells in India and the planting of trees for shade. He appointed officers for the supervision of charitable works. He founded hospitals and public gardens. He had gardens made for the growing of medicinal herbs. Had he had an Aristotle to inspire him, he would no doubt have endowed scientific research upon a great scale. He created a ministry for the care of the aborigines and subject races. He made provision for the education of women. He was the first monarch to make, an attempt to educate his people into a common view of the ends and way of life. He made vast benefactions to the Buddhist teaching orders and tried to stimulate them to a better study of their own literature. All over the land, he set up long inscriptions rehearsing the teaching of Gautama, and it's the simple and human teaching, and not the preposterous accretions. 35 of his inscriptions survive to this day. Moreover, he sent missionaries to spread the noble and reasonable teaching of his master throughout the world, to Kashmir, to Ceylon, to the Seleucids, and to the Ptolemies. It was one of these missions which carried that cutting of the bow tree, of which we've already told, to Ceylon. For 28 years, Asoka worked sanely for the real needs of men. Amidst the tens of thousands of names of monarchs that crowd the columns of history, their majesties and graciousness and serenities and royal highnesses and the like, the name of Asoka shines, and shines almost alone, a star. From the Volga to Japan, his name is still honored. China, Tibet, and even India, though it has left his doctrine, preserve the tradition of his greatness. More living men cherish his memory today than have ever heard the names of Constantine or Charlemagne. Fifth, it's thought that the vast benefactions of Asoka finally corrupted Buddhism by attracting to its order great numbers of mercenary and insincere adherents, but there can be no doubt that its rapid extension throughout Asia was very largely due to his stimulus. It made its way into Central Asia through Afghanistan and Turkestan, and so reached China. Buddhist teaching had spread widely in China before 200 BC. Buddhism found there a popular and prevalent religion, Taoism, a development of very ancient and primitive magic and occult practices. It was reorganized as a distinctive cult by Chang Duoling in the days of the Han Dynasty. Tao means the way, which corresponds closely with the idea of the Aryan path. The two religions spread side by side and underwent similar changes, so that nowadays their outward practice is very similar. Buddhism also encountered Confucianism, which was even less theological and even more a code of personal conduct. And finally, it encountered the teachings of Lao Tse, anarchist, evolutionist, pacifist, and moral philosopher, which weren't so much a religion as a philosophical rule of life. The teachings of this Lao Tse were later to become incorporated with the Taoist religion of Chen Tuan, the founder of modern Taoism. Confucius, the founder of Confucianism, like the great southern teacher Lao Tse and Gautama, lived also in the 6th century BC. His life has some interesting parallelisms with that of some of the more political of the Greek philosophers of the 5th and 4th. The 6th century BC falls into the period assigned by Chinese historians to the Chu dynasty, but in those days the rule of that dynasty had become little more than nominal. The emperor conducted the traditional sacrifices of the Son of Heaven and received a certain formal respect. Even his nominal empire wasn't a sixth part of the China of today. In chapter 14, we've already glanced at the state of affairs in China at this time. Practically, China was a multitude of warring states open to the northern barbarians. Confucius was a subject in one of those states, Lu. He was of aristocratic birth, but poor, and after occupying various official positions, he set up a sort of academy in Lu, for the discovery and imparting of wisdom. And we also find Confucius travelling from state to state in China, seeking a prince who would make him his counsellor and become the centre of a reformed world. Plato, 2 centuries later, in exactly the same spirit, went as adviser to the tyrant Dionysius of Syracuse, and we've already noted the attitudes of Aristotle and Isocrates towards Philip of Macedonia. The teaching of Confucius centred upon the idea of a noble life which he embodied in a standard or ideal, the aristocratic man. This phrase is often translated into English as the superior person, but as superior and person, like respectable and genteel, have long become semi-humorous terms of abuse, this rendering isn't fair to Confucianism. He did present to his time the ideal of a devoted public man. The public side was very important to him. He was far more of a constructive political thinker than Gautama or Lao Tse. His mind was full of the condition of China, and he sought to call the aristocratic man into existence very largely in order to produce the noble state. One of his sayings may be quoted here: "It's impossible to withdraw from the world and associate with birds and beasts that have no affinity with us. With whom should I associate but with suffering men? The disorder that prevails is what requires my efforts. If right principles ruled through the kingdom, there would be no necessity for me to change its state." The political basis of his teaching seems to be characteristic of Chinese moral ideas. There's a much directer reference to the state than is the case with most Indian and European moral and religious doctrine. For a time, he was appointed magistrate in Chengdu, a city of the dukedom of Lu, and here he sought to regulate life to an extraordinary extent, to subdue every relationship and action indeed, to the rule of an elaborate etiquette. Ceremonial in every detail, such as we are wont to see only in the courts of rulers and the households of high dignitaries, became obligatory on the people at large, and all matters of daily life were subject to rigid rule. Even the food, which the different classes of people might eat, was regulated. Males and females were kept apart in the streets. Even the thickness of coffins and the shape and situation of graves were made the subject of regulations. This is all, as people say, very Chinese. No other people have ever approached moral order and social stability through the channel of manners. Yet in China, at any rate, the methods of Confucius have had an enormous effect, and no nation in the world today has such a universal tradition of decorum and self-restraint. Later on, the influence of Confucius over his duke was undermined, and he withdrew again into private life. His last days were saddened by the deaths of some of his most promising disciples. "No intelligent ruler," he said, "arises to take me as his master, and my time has come to die."